Hey there. My name's Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table's a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is an edited version of something that we call the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with the hope that it can be a positive catalyst and encouragement to you in your own explorations. In our experience, exploring what we believe can sometimes be hard work, and we don't think anybody should have to do that alone. We're able to offer this because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond a local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com. Thanks for dropping by. Just a brief additional word of explanation about the podcast that follows. This is the edited version of a gathering at the table that we call an Alt Sunday. And on Alt Sundays, the form of what we're doing can be anything. And there's no sort of liturgy or order that's prescribed in any way for those gatherings. And so this particular one, each of the stories that I share was followed by a conversation and discussion time, which we didn't include on the podcast. So you may wish to, after each of the stories that eventually shows up in this podcast, you may wish to just hit the pause button and do your own reflecting, or you may wish to just roll through them. Your choice, obviously. But just so you know what was happening in the background that you don't hear on the podcast might help with your consideration of how you'll engage with this one. As always, thanks for listening. Welcome to the Talky Bit. Welcome to the podcast. There's this thing that we forget sometimes when it comes to our beliefs, however we arrived at them, were handed them, which is that they're not static. And maybe we're reminded, maybe in a community like this where people are committed to and interested in exploring what they believe, maybe we're reminded by our own journey and our own experiences that that's the case, that our beliefs are not static, that they change, they evolve, that that they don't always behave themselves. the world doesn't always line up with them tidily. So it's easy to treat them as though they were sort of external buttresses, big, solid, not movable things that we then kind of move around and work with. And we forget sometimes in those experiences that whatever the beliefs are that we're surrounded by or that we carry ourselves are things that at some point were made. Somebody thought of something. Somebody had an idea. Somebody gathered other people around that idea. There was a culture around that idea. Beliefs are assemblies of pieces that are already there, sort of like a car or a building. There are all these discrete parts that then get put together in a certain order, and they take a shape that we recognize and that we can respond to and interact with and make meaning of. And over time, always, if there's an unchanging or less changing part of this, I would say that it's that over time, they always change because their context changes, and that changes them. They are assemblies of context. They are assembled pieces of the context, the cultural context that we're in. Christian belief, any belief, but the one that most of us in this room and in this community would have in common historically at least, Christian belief is not some noteworthy exception to this reality. And all you have to do is take History of Christianity 101 anywhere, pick up the book, take the course to kind of go, oh, this came from somewhere and it's changed its shape a great deal over the time in which it has held that name, and it continues to change. And we've talked about this before in this space, but there's at least sort of one thoughtful scholar of religion, that's a contemporary scholar of religion, who would like to say that about every 500 years there's a rummage sale inside a religion, and we take all the things that we believe in that religion and we put them out on the floor and we're like, this one's still good, I still use that every week, you know, the sort of the keep, discard, giveaway pile or whatever your process is for tidying up the basement, and we get rid of some things and we keep some things. And it changes. And then when we take those things, we start to look at them and go, oh, well, that one's still good, but it needed a something to complete it or complement it or augment it. And so we look around at the things we have to work with, and we find something that fits in that space, and we add that in and carry on. And that the last time we did this in Christianity was about 500 years ago. She posits that this happens about every 500 years in Western history, and we're due, and argues that, I think in a very defensible argument, that we're in the middle of exactly that. Completely different scholar from a completely different vantage point. So that's a Christian American scholar of religion who makes that argument, an American scholar of religion who I think makes no particular claim to a particular religion at this point, but who grew up Muslim, converted to evangelical Christianity, and who has since moved on from that, a very thoughtful sort of thinker about all of this, but grew up Muslim, would say that he believes that Islam is just coming into its first experience of a reformation, which is not that hard to see when you look around in Canadian culture, where we have Canadian Muslims, women, for example, writing books about Muslims and sexuality, you know, something that hasn't been on the table for discussion in Islam in a public way, maybe ever. So I'm not a scholar of that religion, so I should want to be careful about making dogmatic statements about that, but that was certainly her take on it. So these things are not unusual. In the context of Christianity, and one of the things, sorry, I should just say one of the things that often gets worked with in these circumstances are the images, right? The kind of the big pieces, those big chunks that we assemble the whole thing out of and by which we make meaning. And one of the big pieces is, generally speaking, is a category, is images. And one of the images in the history of Christianity, standing as it does on the patriarchal structures of Judaism, has been, patriarchy has been, the image of a father. And of course, in contemporary Christianity, or sort of post-Middle Ages Christianity for sure, even earlier than that, Tertullian, I think about 200 years into the story, was the first person to use this language in anything we have in a document. The language of the Christian notion about the divine as three parts, yet one, so a trinity comprised of a father, a son, and a spirit. So that, those images are very familiar. They're so familiar that we use them culturally without even outside of any reference to the religion. They're prevailing images. They've been around for a couple thousand years, give or take, and they've got some traction. They've got some history, but also up for review, like all the other images, up for evolution. And they've evolved in the past. So what I wanted to do was give us a little glimpse of some of that past evolution, just to see us maybe what some of the trajectory of this is and has been. And then what I want us to do is we're going to hear about some other father images from a variety of writers. I'll give you some context for that in a minute. And the question I want us to be musing about together this morning and to discuss a little bit as we're able and comfortable is, if we had understood fatherhood the way each of these writers that I'm going to read to us understands and experiences the fatherhood experience, how might that have informed a different imagination of the divine as a father? How would it have been different than an unassailable, powerful patriarch? Good and kind in the Christian story, but nevertheless, the power. And so, you know, there's a point of evolution there. So the poem, I want to start with a poem, which is called Descent, as in coming down. Malcolm Gait poem. And Gait is, I mean, he's a priest, but he's also a scholar, and so has a deep knowledge of all things Greek and Roman. And this poem references that and compares the Greek and Roman, the classic images of the divine, to the emerging, you know, 2,000 years ago emerging images, Christian images of the divine. And it compares them. So the language here is distinctly, unapologetically Christian, and that's the perspective of the poet, but also contains this knowledge of where some of those ideas came from and how they were changing in early Christianity. And some of those we still experience pretty deep echoes of. But let me just read you the poem, and then we'll go on. Descent. They sought to soar into the skies, those classic gods of high renown, for lofty pride aspires to rise. But you came down. You dropped down from the mountains sheer, forsook the eagle for the dove. The other gods demanded fear, but you gave love. Where chiseled marble seemed to freeze their abstract and perfected form, compassion brought you to your knees. Your blood was warm. They called for blood and sacrifice. Their victims on an altar bled. When no one else could pay the price, you died instead. They towered above our mortal plane, dismissed this restless flesh with scorn, aloof from birth and death and pain. But you were born. Born to these burdens, born by all, born with us all astride the grave, weak to be with us when we fall, and strong to save. So regardless of whether that story shape, which is this poem was written on the eve of Christmas, it's an incarnation poem in Christian language and theological language. It's about God becoming human in Christ, some of those familiar Christian ideas. But that contrast is the bit that I wanted to get at together today. That movement from, I mean, the Greeks and the Romans weren't apologetic about their take on the divine. They were deeply vested in it. So were the Christians, deeply vested in theirs. But these are very different images, very different possibilities. And that contrast sort of reveals that evolution. It's hardly a wonder when you see it in a compressed form like that, that there were people who were like, what about the Christian beliefs, right? And especially given that, you know, the Messiah figure didn't survive an exercise of Roman power, except inside of the story that the Christians were telling. So that's kind of interesting, right? All in itself. And I think Guyte captures that contrast brilliantly in the poem. Here's what I would like us to do by way of sort of considering possible future trajectories or places of exploration for evolving our own and watching other people and listening to other people evolve their understanding of the divine. These are all acts of imagination. I think that's rather important to remember. Anytime we're making something by which we're making meaning, it's an act of imagination. I heard somebody point out this morning in a fascinating interview that science at its heart is an act of imagination. That when you make a hypothesis, that's an imaginary thing that's unproven that you're going to test. When you try to decide how you're going to test it and you design an experiment, that's a creative act. Creative acts spring from the imagination. So even this thing that we might tend to regard as data-driven, objectively verifiable, and so on and so forth, has its core in imagination. And if we believe the things that science tells us, it's worth remembering that we are believing things that someone imagined in precisely the same human way that we do when we believe a religious or spiritual thing. It's the same human act. So I think that's rather important to remember as we do this exercise, at least. So what I want to do, this is based on, and there are several of these pieces that I'm going to read, and we'll have a little pause after each one to reflect. But in 2019, the Washington Post sent out a sort of a general call to people who identified as fathers in advance of Father's Day. And they said, like writers, journalists, that kind of thing. And they were like, give us, in 500 words or less, give us the moment where being a dad became real to you. Write about it. Tell us about that. And then they selected kind of their greatest hits, their top five, and they published them. And these are those letters. And I should say, I don't know if I want to call it a trigger warning, maybe in some people's context, but I certainly want a heads up warning here. There's a wide variety of stories here. Some of them are heartbreaking. They touch on most of the challenges that people face when it comes to adding children to a family. And lots of different iterations, so they're included here are stories of loss and stories of varieties of ways of becoming expectant and of adoption and, anyway, quite a range. So just be aware that some of these stories will touch on some of those themes. Care for your well-being as you listen to them as you need and wish to. So I'm just going to read them, credit them to their authors, and then we'll talk about that question of if this had been your story, your image of what constitutes fatherhood, how might it have impacted the way you imagined the divine as a father if you should choose to imagine the divine in such a way? All right. My wife's belly protruded as she lay on the couch occasionally asking me to come feel the kicks. Even as I felt the pings of our child's life against her skin and my palm, I did not feel like it was mine. At the hospital, my wife ached in pain on the bed. I looked into her eyes and told her, everything will be okay. We deserved a family. I deserved to be a father. Seconds after my child was born, the doctor lifted him up, showing me the miracle of birth. They wrapped him up and put him in my arms like that's where he belonged. Meanwhile, I was lost. Was I a father? The days and nights went on. I slept next to him and my wife in the hospital bed, swaddled him, held him, and changed him. I was amazed at the life smiling up at me. However, the connection was a loose-hanging thread. I had not come to terms with who I was. It wasn't until nights later that I felt something growing inside of me.
The baby screamed, calling me through the monitor. My wife slept in bed as I crept into my son's room. I picked him up onto my chest and sat in the rocking chair. In the stillness of the night, I realized it was my first moment alone in days, weeks, or months to comprehend this time. The first thoughts were of my father's passing only months before. The phone call from my brother that he'd stopped breathing, my mother on the phone, the long flight, the disbelief of seeing his jacket still hanging on the chair in the garage. Years before, we had sat in the dining room, and I told him I didn't want to refer to him as my stepfather. He deserved something more. I said, "I want to call you Pops." I imagined he'd be here to meet my son, but the room was as empty as my heart. As tears pooled on my lids, I pictured the moment when I was standing next to the hospital bed of my biological father. A smile radiated from his frail, cancer-ridden body. He told me he was sorry for not being there throughout my life. I said I forgave him and didn't hate him. And my mind went to my other fathers. Grandpa showing me the twisting of his wrench under the car hood, my uncle leading my pencil to draw. The moment came when my child calmed in my arms and the ache in my chest beat on his while I wept like a baby. It was then I knew he was mine and I was his. I was the father I'd always hoped for. So the writer is someone named Anthony Ellis. So when we hear a story like that about a father, and should we choose to do so, we engage our imaginations and we think, if God was that sort of father, as opposed to an all-powerful patriarchal notion of a father, how would it change the way we thought about the divine, about the nature of God? We'll have more opportunities. Let me give us another one. Feeling like a father is supposed to be easy. And with my oldest, it was. There was an instant connection the second I held him, and that was that. But Sam, my secondborn, was a different story. He never slept, he always cried, and he hated when I held him. It had been a difficult pregnancy for my wife, and with so many scares, on top of previous infertility issues, I was more exhaustedly relieved than joyful when he was born. During the next few weeks of colic and crying and hardly a second of sleep, a sudden and grim realization hit me. I was more in love with the idea of a second kid than my actual second child. When I took my paternity leave and dutifully took up my fatherly duties, it was more of a sleepwalk than an eager call to action. I was just going through the motions, getting frustrated too easily, and handing him back to my wife too quickly. I vividly remember rocking him in a glider that had caused quite a fight between my wife and me before he was born, as I didn't feel we had the room in the nursery or our budget for anything else. So, naturally, we bought it. There I sat, night after night, counting the minutes and trying to get him down as quickly as possible so I could sneak out and do something else, anything else, other than be with this temperamental baby. The cherry on top of all of that frustration, the entire mountain of resentment, was dealing with a kid who wouldn't sleep while being confined to that penalty box of a chair I didn't even want in the first place. But I went back and read my own writing from the years before. 5 miscarriages and an abortion due to seronomalia trying to get to our second child. A deep reservoir of heartbreak and stress that nearly broke us as a couple, capped off with in vitro fertilization and injections and close calls during which we held our breath and expected the worst, fearing silence instead of the sound of a beating heart filling the terrifying confines of the exam room. I realized I wasn't being punished. I was being rewarded. So, I started holding Sam just to hold him. I sat in that chair in the darkness and held my youngest son to my chest while I sang to him. I relaxed with him, and eventually he responded. I reclined in the chair, and Sam turned his head and nuzzled his face into my chest while his tiny fingers found my thumb and gripped it tight. His little body rising and falling with my breathing helped put everything into focus, and the two of us drifted off to sleep. That was the first time, months after his birth, I felt like Sam's father.
in a chair I never wanted, holding the child I desperately did. That's from Aaron Govia. I sometimes think that some of the writers who've given us the images we have in the Judeo-Christian story of God as a divine father might have had experiences a little bit akin to this one, because there's an ambivalence about God's affection, especially in First Testament texts, where you kind of like, is he going to turn the corner or isn't he? You know, like it's there in the stories big time, right? And it's there, there's bargaining stories in those texts, right? Where somebody's like, if there's 20 righteous people in the city, promise you won't nuke it? Like if there's 10, if there's 2, if there's 1, and they're trying to just get to their kids, you know, and kind of go, if my kids are there, will they be okay? And just wondering, is God going to, you know, smite the whole mess? And in some ways, that's that father image, isn't it? Of the ambivalence, of the difficulty, of the, I know this should be about love, but it's about a bunch of other things as well. Anyway, that's what comes to my mind when I read that story and I think about the evolving images of God, and even why we've had such difficulty, if we grew up around New Testament Christianity, for example, why sometimes we've had such difficulty with the moments in those stories where Jesus isn't like an airbrushed, groovy, peaceful, slightly stoned, happy all the time, loving hippie, where he turns some tables over or gives somebody the gears about something or tells a dear friend to walk, you know? Right? There's those bits are in those stories too. So I don't know what comes to your mind. All right. Another? Jessica shimmied and shook her groove thing in the ultrasound room, and I smiled, trying to stifle a giddy and joyful laugh as I watched my wife dance. The ultrasound tech had asked her to move around so she could get a better look at our 12-week-old baby. Our first pregnancy, 8 months prior, had ended in an early miscarriage before we'd even witnessed a heartbeat. But all was good so far. This was the real deal, and I'd waited a long time for this. Finally, in my early 40s, I was a father. I could picture my daughter's thick, dark hair and brown eyes just like her Italian mama. I imagined she would be called Sophia. A knock at the door ended the revelry, and a doctor strode in with the ultrasound tech. My wife returned to the table. The tech applied the cool gel to her still small belly, placed the wand across her stomach, and our baby appeared on the screen. To my untrained eyes, she looked perfect, and I could make out the vigorous beating of her heart. The doctor spoke quietly to the tech, asking for a closer look here, a closer look there. After a few minutes, it was over, and he said he'd speak to us once Jessica was dressed. He left the room, and moments later, the tech led us to an office where we sat down, unprepared for what came next. "I'm sorry to tell you the fetus has a fatal condition and will not survive," he said, matter-of-factly. "This is not a viable pregnancy, and you will want to terminate. The fetus has a condition known as acrania, meaning the skull has not formed. You can learn more by Googling acrania, but I would advise you not to look at any photos or show them to your wife," he said, as if she wasn't sitting right there. He left the room, and we held hands and wept. The next few days passed in a blur. We called our mothers. God can do miracles, they both insisted. We spoke with our priest. We met with a gynecologist. We dreamed of holding our baby. We will do whatever is best for you, we whispered to her. We saw a specialist for a second opinion. She was a sensitive and patient doctor and spent an hour with us looking over the ultrasound, confirming the initial diagnosis. The pompadour you see there, she explained, is brain tissue floating above the unformed skull. The baby, she confirmed, would not survive more than a few hours or days after birth if it made it that far. I suppose you never really feel like a father until you've had to make some gut-wrenching decision about your child. So, this was it. Fatherhood. A few days later, we returned to the hospital. I squeezed my wife's hand one last time before she was led away, and I said a quiet prayer for the daughter I'd never meet. That's from Dwayne Hayes. We think about evolving our notions of God as a father in a story of loss like that, of incompleteness like that. What sorts of thoughts come to mind? One of my friends, who's someone who's studied
the Judeo-Christian history of the Christian tradition quite extensively, to the point of learning some of those languages and spending time in those countries and really quite vested in it. Someone who would no longer identify as a Christian but who continues to be intrigued by this collection of stories likes to suggest that really in the end all of the stories are us as humans, not just the Christian stories, but all of these meaning-making stories that we put together are always of us basically trying to deal with our own existential dread, right? Our own sense of incompleteness, our own experience of not being able to see it or understand everything we wish to see or understand, feel like we need to know. And since we can't know, how can we navigate? Well, the stories help us to navigate, right? They give us some way of proceeding in the face of all of that mystery and uncertainty. That's what comes to my mind when I hear Duane Hayes' story. You know, this this sense of closing, bringing some closure to the story of being a father, even though the standard things that typically constitute the bones of that story were not his experience. This child did not arrive in the world to be held and carried physically. And yet here's someone who's like, yep, that was our child. I'm a dad. This is the decision that we made about this child out of love and care. You know, and so that feels to me like it lands right at that intersection of the things we can't know but choose to believe. I'm also intrigued by how many of these stories have a really significant theme of incompleteness and loss in them. This one's a little different. I embraced fatherhood the moment my wife exclaimed, "It's plus, it's plus," notifying me in the wee hours that the early pregnancy test was positive. But it was a query by a 2-year-old standing at the mailbox that inspired me to become more intentional about fatherhood, to examine who I wanted to be in the eyes of my child. I should have anticipated the mail request. "Daddy, where's my mail?" Whatever his daddy did, he did. Wherever his daddy went, he went. If daddy received mail, so too should mini-me. The demand for mail was the outward expression of my son's inward imitation of me. Standing at the mailbox, I attempted to dissuade him from wanting mail. "Naeem," I said, "the only thing in the mailbox is junk mail and bills. Trust me, you don't want either, especially not bills." It was as if my lips moved, but I was mute. "Daddy, where is my mail?" he said again. So, I set out for Target. I figured I'd pick up some postcards and greeting cards, I'd mail them to him intermittently, and that would be the end of his fascination with mail. However, as I wrote in the first card, almost immediately my goal changed from offering my son occasional patronizing platitudes to sharing words that he could live by for the rest of his life. After signing each card, my heart opened wider. I communicated all the things I hoped for Naeem's life, the depth of my love for him, I confessed honestly. With every written word, I did what my dad would never do, that I longed for him to do, love me unconditionally. See, I'm the product of a broken father-son relationship. Upon discovering I was going to be a father, I pledged, like many men, to be a better father than my dad. But new dads often make pledges and good intentions that never manifest. Too often, like my son imitating my receipt of mail, well-intentioned sons become our undesirable fathers. My son and I held hands as we walked to the mailbox that day. When we returned, I held his hand, and the makings to be the father I always wanted. More important, the father Naeem deserved. I now know writing Naeem was the prescription I needed to recover from a broken heart and the contractual language cementing my pledge to be a better man. 20 years later, I still write to my son, my best friend. Although the hundreds of cards, postcards, notes, and letters are his, they continue to serve us both. Who would have known that 5 words, "Daddy, where is my mail," would change my relationship with my son forever? That's from Nathaniel A. Turner. Let me ask a more specific, focused question about this one. If we think about this idea that I hold close, that whatever it is that we make in terms of meaning-making stories or mythologies or narratives or beliefs about the divine, those are things we make. So we make God in that regard. that the stories we tell in making something outside of ourselves like that are actually the stories that shape the teller. The way that Nathaniel's letters to his son shaped him. That there's a reciprocity in this story making, in the choice to act on our image making that actually doesn't even come home to us in the sense that that's where it came from. That it only leaves us in our imagination. I don't know a better way to say that off the cuff. I'd have to give that some thought. Any of that make any sense at all, or is there anything there to push against or protest, discuss, other thoughts? First time I felt like a dad, I'd never met my son. He was a doughy two-dimensional boy in a grainy picture living half a world away. On this cold December day, though, after staring at that picture, I became a dad. The day after accepting our referral, I did what most soon-to-be parents might do. I went shopping. Entering Baby Gap, a patch-laden denim jacket caught my eye. Plunking down the $20 to buy the jacket made me feel even more like a dad. Although I was beginning to feel like a father, I knew very little about my son. I knew that his name was Yosef. I knew Yosef needed a loving family. I knew our home pined for his presence in it. As the cashier stuffed the Gap denim into the bag that day, I knew our little boy would be wearing that jacket as he met us, his forever family, at the airport someday soon. Our new son wouldn't need the jacket yet. It turns out, though, I did. Like most adoption stories, our happy denim jacket adorning airport introduction was delayed. Days of waiting to meet our son bled into weeks of impatience before giving way to months of putting our lives on hold. The waiting was excruciating. I passed time engulfed in work, yard maintenance, and tidying the nursery for our little man's arrival. As I cleaned Yosef's room, our family felt like a long way off. On those days, I'd refold the denim jacket, place it on the top of Yosef's dresser, and again, feel like a dad. When our final travel plans materialized, that jacket was first into Yosef's backpack. I couldn't shake the fatherly feeling of packing diapers, bottles, socks, onesies, and pacifiers as we anxiously prepared to leave for Addis Ababa to finally meet our son. The next week in Ethiopia was a whirlwind. I was officially and unmistakably forever Yosef's dad. I felt, though, like an overwhelmed, unprepared stranger. Yosef didn't know me. I was the first white face that would ever hold him close. I'd be uprooting him from the only life he'd ever known. I was overjoyed and overwhelmed. All adoptions begin with sadness. And that week, I came face to face with that reality. Taking care of this beautiful boy was new to me and scary. Yosef seemed unsure, too. I reflected about this between connecting flights while changing diapers and through upended sleep schedules on our way back home with Yosef, sitting at our departure gate in Chicago's O'Hare Airport, racked with nerves, half asleep, and short on confidence. I readied Yosef for the final flight home. I unfolded that Gap denim jacket, pulling Yosef's chubby hands through. I spent time looking into his endless dark eyes. I smiled. He smiled back. Yosef had no idea what he was in for, but I did. I was his dad. Then, now, and after he'd outgrow that Gap denim that helped me get to this day. It's from Tobin Walsh. We can feel like that sentence in Tobin's story of all adoptions begin with sadness. I think lots of times when we're exploring what we believe and evolving our own beliefs, and there's a leaving that's part of that, as well as a moving to that's a part of that, that's, I think, a very similar sort of sadness to what he's gesturing toward. That I cannot stay
in my place of origin. But I need all the things, I need many of the things that I found there in terms of belonging. Anyway,
I didn't choose the order of these. I present them in the order in which I found them. And when I was reading them this morning, and I read the last sentence of the last one, and I reflected on why I wanted to share them with this community, had I been deliberate about it, I don't think I could have chosen a better last sentence. So I'll just say that, and then we'll get there through the story. I really struggled in 2009 to find the best roadmap to help guide me during the nearly 35 weeks that my wife spent pregnant with our twin boys. The time for guesswork, I figured, would be over after their arrival. And so, I read far too many books, blog posts, and peer-reviewed medical journals. I looked for clues everywhere and interrogated any parent foolish enough to make eye contact with me. As the only child of parents who died nearly a decade earlier, I didn't benefit from the firsthand parental advice that's often passed down to grown children who are expecting. So I did the best I could to try to understand just what parenthood would be like. But I could never really get at the heart of what I was searching for. What exactly, or so rather, when exactly would the weight of fatherhood hit me? I really enjoyed each phase of my wife's pregnancy. From the moment we first realized that a tiny being might be growing inside her, to the shocking discovery that one was actually two, to seeing their puffy face three-dimensional images displayed on an ultrasound machine, I soaked up each milestone, but didn't dare confuse any of it with active parenting. I might not have been an expert, but all my reading had informed my thinking that my parenthood moment probably would arrive sometime after the birth of my twin boys. Exactly when, however, was anyone's guess, including mine. I'd fallen asleep reading one of our many parenting books when my wife woke me at 2:37 a.m. to tell me that she thought her water broke 5 weeks early. We quickly snapped out of our days, put our birth plan into action. I thought I'd have a few more weeks. Our babies, it seemed, laughed at our naive. After about 10 hours of labor, our first baby boy arrived. He was beautiful and scrawny and weighed 4 pounds, 4 ounces. About 90 minutes later, his brother arrived, weighing just 6 ounces more. They were healthy, but several ounces lighter than the weight that would have allowed us to take them home after my wife's brief recovery period in the hospital. So we were new parents who arrived home without our babies. For the next several days, we made regular visits to the hospital's neonatal intensive care unit to thank the nurses who cared for our babies and to change their diapers and feed them milk from tiny bottles. Dean, the slightly larger twin, was discharged several days before his brother, Carrie. My wife and I felt intense guilt not being able to bring both boys home together. That first night, we brought Dean to his room and placed his tiny body in a crib in a room whose color patterns we'd fussed over till the bitter end. My wife and I exchanged nervous glances. We went to our bedroom, which was less than 30 feet away, turned up the baby monitor, and lay in bed until we drifted off to sleep. We were awakened by the most beautiful yet pitiful little cry you could imagine. We both jumped up and hurried for Dean's room. With Carrie remaining for several more days in the NICU and Dean at home with two novices for parents, nothing seemed ideal. My fatherhood moment, it seemed, had arrived. I now have twin boys who are rapidly approaching eye level with my wife, and a 7-year-old daughter, Claire, who can keep her brothers and her father on their toes. I'm still not prepared. I probably never will be. There is no playbook. There is no playbook that guarantees success, because being a parent is not like baking a cake. In that sense, my fatherhood moment is continuous and evolving. The end. So that sentence, my fatherhood moment is continuous and evolving, that's the sentence where when I read it in review, I was like, oh, that kind of captures it for me. Certainly not for everyone, and even not for each of these stories, right? But the fact that this is not a static thing,
And that when we make images from it that are about belief or meaning, those shouldn't be static things or needn't be static things either. And in fact, in some ways, they are the most filled with rich possibilities when we don't insist on making them static. The insistence that they have nowhere left to go, I think, is one short step from the kind of hubris about them that would cause us to behave in the name of those beliefs in ways that history makes it very clear are ultimately destructive, even if they are well-intentioned. So openness to the story changing and evolving, I think, is somehow of the essence in this. That's all I'm gonna do with that this morning. And over to you, and anyone who's listening to the podcast, over to you, to continue to evolve what we believe, to explore what we believe, including our images of the divine, including those images of the divine that might operate in the realm of or around or based on our notions about and experiences of what it means to be or have a father. Peace.